Welcome to the Utica Phoenix deep dive into the death of Robert Brooks.
Yeah, a very very heavy topic for sure. We're kind of looking into what happened to Robert Brooks at Marcy Correctional Facility and, you know, trying to understand how something so awful could happen.
Yeah, it's tough to even process some of the details coming out of these articles. We've got reports from the Utica Observer-Dispatch and Democrat and Chronicle, national coverage from CBS News, and even in-depth analysis from the Marshall Project, which focuses on criminal justice issues. It seems like this case has really struck a chord with people.
It has, and rightfully so. There's something about this case that goes beyond, you know, the usual headlines about prison violence. Maybe it's the fact that we have that body camera footage, the sheer brutality of it. It's hard to ignore.
Absolutely. Before we dive into the specifics of what happened at Marcy, can you give us some background on Robert Brooks? Who was he?
So Robert Brooks was a 43-year-old black man from Greece, New York. He was serving a 12-year sentence for first-degree assault, which stemmed from a 2016 incident where he stabbed his girlfriend. So 9 years into his sentence at the time of his death.
That's a serious crime, no doubt.
Yeah.
But I remember reading in one of the articles that his family described him as a loving father and a talented musician. He was apparently working on a book while incarcerated. It's just so tragic that his life ended this way.
It is. And it's important to acknowledge that even though he had committed a crime, he was still a human being deserving of, you know, basic rights and humane treatment.
Exactly. So how did he end up at Marcy Correctional Facility?
He was transferred there from Mohawk Correctional Facility on December 9th, 2024. And just one day later, he was dead.
One day. What happened in that short time?
That's what everyone is trying to figure out. The details are still emerging, but what we do know is that on December 10th, Brooks was in the prison infirmary. It's unclear why he was there. Some reports suggest he was having a mental health episode.
Okay, so he's in the infirmary, presumably needing medical attention.
Yeah.
And that's where the violence occurred.
Yes. The Attorney General's office released body camera footage showing multiple correctional officers punching, kicking, and choking Brooks while he was handcuffed to a gurney. It's brutal to watch.
I can't even imagine. The reports describe officers striking him with a shoe, lifting him by the neck, and dropping him. It's just sickening.
It is. And the preliminary autopsy findings indicate concern for asphyxia due to compression of the neck as the cause of death.
So it seems likely he was killed by the officers, even if unintentionally. And from what I understand, there's been a lot of discussion about the legal challenges of holding those officers accountable.
Right. One of the first things people need to understand is that in New York State, correctional officers are represented by a very powerful union. And that union contract includes a provision for an arbitration system.
What does that mean exactly? Arbitration system.
It means that if a correctional officer is disciplined or fired, they can appeal that decision to an outside arbitrator. And often these arbitrators end up siding with the officers even when there's evidence of wrongdoing.
So even if those officers are found to have used excessive force, they could potentially keep their jobs.
It's possible, and it's happened before. The Marshall Project actually did a deep dive into this arbitration system back in 2023, and they found that it's incredibly difficult to fire officers for abuse or misconduct.
That's just mind-boggling. It feels like the system is rigged to protect them, not hold them accountable for their actions.
That's how a lot of people feel, especially given the history of abuse allegations at Marcy and other New York prisons. This isn't an isolated incident.
So what needs to change? If the arbitration system is so skewed in favor of the officers, how can we ensure that justice is served in cases like this?
That's a complex question. Some lawmakers are pushing for reforms to the arbitration process, but it's facing stiff resistance from the Corrections Officers Union.
It feels like a classic case of power dynamics at play. But surely there has to be a way to strike a balance between protecting officers' rights and ensuring that they're held accountable for their actions.
There does. And it's not just about the legal system. It's also about addressing the underlying cultural and systemic issues that contribute to this kind of violence.
What do you mean by that?
Well, think about the environment inside a prison. It's often overcrowded, understaffed, and filled with people who are struggling with mental health issues. That kind of environment can create a pressure cooker where violence is more likely to occur.
So you're saying that even if we address the legal challenges, if the underlying conditions remain the same, we're likely to see more incidents like this.
Exactly. It's like trying to fix a leaky roof while the foundation is crumbling. You need to address the root causes if you want to see real change.
So what are those root causes? Where do we even begin to address something so deeply ingrained in the prison system?
That's what we're going to explore in the next part of this deep dive. We'll look at the history of abuse at Marcy, the role of the blue wall of silence, and the calls for reform that are gaining momentum in the wake of Robert Brooks's death.
This is all very heavy stuff, but it's so important to understand these issues. I'm eager to learn more about what needs to change to prevent these kinds of tragedies from happening again.
Me too. It's a long and complicated road ahead, but I believe that change is possible. We just need to keep the pressure on and demand better for everyone involved in the criminal justice system.
Okay, so we've talked about the legal hurdles when it comes to holding correctional officers accountable, but you mentioned the blue wall of silence. What exactly does that mean, and how does it play into all of this?
Well, basically, it's this sort of code of silence among law enforcement, including correctional officers. There's this unspoken rule that you don't rat out your fellow officers even if they've done something wrong.
And why is that? Is it just a loyalty thing, or is there something more to it?
Well, it's partly loyalty, for sure. I mean, these officers work in a high-stress environment. They depend on each other for safety. But it also kind of goes deeper than that. You know, there's this fear of retaliation, of being ostracized, or even jeopardizing your own career if you break the code.
So even if an officer witnesses something like what happened to Robert Brooks, they might hesitate to speak out because of this blue wall.
Exactly. They might fear that, you know, they'll be labeled a snitch, that they'll be targeted by other officers, or that their testimony won't be taken seriously. It creates a culture where abuse can thrive because there's little incentive to report it.
And I imagine that makes it incredibly difficult for investigators to get to the bottom of these cases, especially if there isn't clear video evidence.
It does. It's one of the biggest challenges in holding officers accountable. Even with video evidence, like in the Brooks case, you still need witnesses willing to testify to corroborate what's on the tape.
Right, because the defense will always try to find ways to explain away the actions of the officers, to cast doubt on the video, or to shift blame onto the victim.
Exactly. And that's where the blue wall can be incredibly effective. If you have multiple officers all telling the same story, even if it's fabricated, it creates this powerful narrative that can be hard to refute.
It's almost like a conspiracy of silence that protects the abusers and perpetuates the cycle of violence.
That's a good way to put it. And it's not just about protecting individual officers. It's also about protecting the image of the institution itself.
So there's this pressure to maintain order and control, and admitting that abuse is happening could undermine that authority.
Right. There's this belief that if you acknowledge the problem, it will just make things worse, that it will embolden the inmates and make it harder to maintain control. But of course, the opposite is true. Sweeping abuse under the rug only allows it to fester and grow.
It's a classic case of short-sighted thinking. And it seems like Marcy Correctional Facility has a particularly troubling history in this regard. I remember reading reports about previous allegations of abuse and misconduct at that facility.
Yes. Marcy has been in the spotlight for a long time for its brutal reputation. It's been the subject of numerous investigations and lawsuits over the years, but it seems like little has changed.
So this begs the question, even with the body camera footage and public outcry, will anything actually change this time?
Well, it's hard to say. There's definitely more pressure than ever before, and the fact that the FBI is now involved raises the stakes significantly. But as we've discussed, the system is designed in a way that makes it very difficult to hold officers accountable.
So what needs to happen? What are the potential solutions that can actually make a difference and break down this culture of impunity?
Well, there are several ideas being floated around, but they all come with their own set of challenges. For starters, there's the push to reform the arbitration system.
You mentioned that earlier. What exactly are the proposed changes, and why is the union pushing back so hard?
One of the main proposals is to remove the final say from the arbitrators and give it back to the Department of Corrections, essentially giving them the power to overturn an arbitrator's decision if they believe it's not in the best interest of public safety.
That seems logical. Why wouldn't the union want that?
Well, they see it as an attack on their members' rights, a way for the state to unfairly target officers without due process. They argue that the current system ensures neutrality and prevents bias in disciplinary decisions.
But if the arbitrators are consistently siding with the officers, even in cases of clear misconduct, how is that neutral?
That's the argument from the reform advocates. They point to studies showing a statistically significant bias in favor of the officers in these arbitration cases. They say it's creating a two-tiered system of justice where officers are held to a different standard.
It does seem like a fundamental conflict of interest. But even if we manage to reform the arbitration system, isn't there a risk that the blue wall will still prevent officers from coming forward in the first place?
It's definitely a concern. And that's why some people believe that the focus should be on changing the culture within prisons, on breaking down this us versus them mentality that fosters distrust and animosity between officers and inmates.
And how do you do that? It's not like you can just wave a magic wand and suddenly everyone is singing Kumbaya.
You're right. It's a long and difficult process. It requires a fundamental shift in how we think about the purpose of incarceration. Is it about punishment or is it about rehabilitation and reintegration into society?
Because if it's about rehabilitation, then creating a more humane and supportive environment is crucial.
Exactly. That means addressing issues like overcrowding, providing access to mental health care and educational opportunities, and fostering a culture of respect between staff and inmates.
Okay, but those were all long-term systemic changes. What about more immediate solutions? Are there any steps that can be taken right now to improve accountability and prevent future incidents of abuse?
Yes, there are a few things that could be implemented relatively quickly. One is to strengthen the duty to intervene for correctional officers.
What does that mean exactly? Duty to intervene.
It means that officers have a legal and moral obligation to step in and stop abuse when they see it happening, even if it's being committed by a fellow officer.
So it's not just about not participating in the abuse, it's about actively preventing it.
Right. It's about sending a clear message that turning a blind eye to wrongdoing is not acceptable. Some states have already implemented this kind of policy, and there's evidence to suggest that it can be effective.
But wouldn't that run into the same blue wall problem? How do you enforce a duty to intervene when there's this strong pressure to stay silent?
It's a valid concern, but the idea is that by making it a clear policy backed by strong consequences for inaction, you can start to shift the culture. You make it clear that protecting abusers is not an option. It also empowers officers who do want to speak up by giving them institutional backing.
Okay, so that's one potential solution. What else is being proposed?
Another idea that's gained traction is to increase the use of body cameras and to ensure that the footage is reviewed independently.
We've already seen how powerful that footage can be in the Brooks case. But hasn't Marcy already implemented body cameras?
They have, but there are concerns about how the footage is being used and whether it's being reviewed objectively. Mm-hmm. There have been cases where officers have turned off their cameras during incidents or where the footage has gone missing.
So there needs to be more transparency and accountability in how the body camera program is managed.
Absolutely. And there are also questions about who is reviewing the footage. Right now, it's often done internally by the corrections department, which raises concerns about bias.
So you'd need an independent body, something like a civilian review board, to ensure that the footage is being assessed objectively.
Exactly. That way, you eliminate the potential for conflicts of interest and ensure that there's a fair and impartial investigation.
Okay, so we've got reforming the arbitration system, strengthening the duty to intervene, and improving the body camera program. Those all sound like good ideas in theory, but I can't help but wonder if they're enough to address the deeper systemic issues we talked about earlier.
You're right. They're just pieces of the puzzle. They're important steps, but they won't solve the problem on their own. We also need to address the root causes of prison violence, like overcrowding, understaffing, lack of mental health services, and the dehumanizing effects of incarceration itself.
Those are big, complex issues. I'm not sure where you even begin to tackle something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You just mentioned the ripple effects of this kind of violence. And I think it's easy to get caught up in the legal battles and policy debates and kind of forget about the human impact. You know?
Yeah. It's crucial to remember the families that are caught in the crossfire. You know, Robert Brooks's loved ones are grieving a profound loss, you know, grappling with the injustice of it all. They're left to pick up the pieces, seeking answers and accountability.
And on the flip side, you have the families of the correctional officers involved. You know, their lives are turned upside down, too.
Mm.
They're dealing with the legal fallout, the potential loss of income, and the social stigma.
Absolutely. You know, it's easy to kind of paint these officers as, you know, faceless villains. But they have families, too. Their children are going to school with this hanging over their heads. Their spouses are facing uncertain futures. The impact is far-reaching.
It's a stark reminder that these events have consequences that, you know, extend far beyond the individuals directly involved.
It's like throwing a stone into a pond, you know? The ripples spread outwards, touching countless lives. And the trauma, the pain, it lingers long after the headlines fade.
Thinking about Robert Brooks's family, I was particularly struck by something his sister said in an interview. She talked about his passion for music, how he dreamt of sharing his talents with the world.
Yeah, that really resonated with me, too. It humanizes him. Mm-hmm. Reminds us that he was more than just an inmate, more than just a statistic. He had hopes, dreams, aspirations, and those were tragically cut short.
Makes you question the whole purpose of incarceration. If someone is working towards rehabilitation, trying to better themselves, shouldn't the system support those efforts rather than crushing them?
That's the ideal, isn't it? But the reality is that our prison system often does the opposite. It fosters a culture of violence and despair, making it incredibly difficult for individuals to break free from the cycle of crime.
And that brings us back to the question of reform.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about legal changes, policy changes, but is there a way to change the very culture of our prisons?
That's a million-dollar question. It's going to require a massive shift in mindset, both from those within the system and from society as a whole. We need to move away from this punitive mentality and embrace a more rehabilitative approach.
But isn't that a bit naive? We're talking about people who have committed serious crimes. Don't they deserve to be punished?
Punishment is certainly a part of the equation, but it shouldn't be the only goal. We need to recognize that most people in prison will eventually be released back into society. Don't we want them to be equipped to lead productive lives? To contribute rather than reoffend?
Of course. But how do we get there? It seems like such a monumental task.
It is, but it starts with small steps. Investing in educational programs, providing job training, offering mental health and substance abuse treatment. These are all proven methods for reducing recidivism.
And what about the correctional officers? They're a key part of the equation, too. How do we change their mindset? Break down that us versus them mentality.
It starts with better training. Emphasizing de-escalation techniques, conflict resolution, and cultural sensitivity. We need to equip them with the tools to handle difficult situations without resorting to violence.
And creating a work environment where they feel supported, respected, and valued. If they're constantly on edge feeling threatened, they're more likely to react with aggression.
Absolutely. It's about fostering a culture of mutual respect. Recognizing that everyone within the system, both staff and inmates, deserves to be treated with dignity.
It's a tall order, but it's a goal worth striving for. And hopefully the tragic death of Robert Brooks will serve as a catalyst for real change. His story has touched so many people, sparked important conversations about the state of our prisons.
It's a wake-up call, a reminder that we can't afford to ignore these issues any longer. We need to demand better for those who are incarcerated and for the dedicated professionals who work within the system.
This deep dive has been eye-opening, challenging, and at times heartbreaking. But it's also given me hope that change is possible.
Me too. It's going to take a collective effort. But I believe we can create a more just and humane criminal justice system, one that focuses on rehabilitation and redemption rather than punishment and retribution.
Thanks for listening to the Utica Phoenix Deep Dive. Subscribe to our YouTube channel for more in-depth investigations. Let's work together to prevent tragedies like this from ever happening again.